You're listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
It's coming home. It's coming.
Oh, the singing has got to stop.
It is coming home, Lionel. It actually might well be coming home. History has been made today. We've seen history be made in Belgium. Paul Sex has become the tallest rider, we think, ever to win Flèche Wallonne. It's a simple race, so we're going to spoiler it straight off the bat in very simple fashion today. What an extraordinary afternoon. What an extraordinary day. If the race itself wasn't extraordinary, then the result, I would suggest to you, is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, the result is extraordinary. We were telegraphing this yesterday, weren't we? I was very confident that Paul Sexsas would win, despite not ever seeing him race the Mur de Huy or the Ardennes Classics or really any race where he has started in this fashion as a favourite, other really than Strada Bianca at the start of the spring, where he was second, of course, behind rampaging Tadej Pogacar. I just wish that I could have placed a bet on it. I don't really bet on sport. Well, I don't.
Well, he was very low. Very low odds, Lionel. We talked about that yesterday. He was the favourite, in fact.
Yeah. And he was the debutant, the first debutant to win Flèche Wallonne since Mark Hirschi in 2020. And we've talked a lot, haven't we, over the years about the Mur de Huy being this sort of secret code that riders sometimes take several years to crack. And some very good riders struggled to get to grips with the Mur de Huy. Some never managed to conquer it. But Paul Sexsas has won at the first attempt. I mean, even Tadej Pogacar took four goes to win it, the Flèche Wallonne. So that gives a little bit of context to the sort of scale of the victory we've seen today. And of course, it continues this trajectory that he is on. And, well, we'll perhaps talk in the second part about the implications for Liège-Bastogne-Liège and then his probable, I would suggest now, participation in the Tour de France this summer.
Well, Lionel, we did an episode yesterday. Of course, we talked a lot about Paul Sexsas. We talked even about the ongoing saga of where he's going to ride after 2027. These rumours that Emmanuel Macron was about to intervene in the dossier. I know people were surprised that Macron was actually on the podcast yesterday, but shortly after the finish today, I managed to contact him again at the Élysée Palace. He was just finishing up his Super Lognon for lunch, and I asked him, is cycling indeed coming home? This is what he said.
For sure.
This is almost fraudulent podcasting, Daniel, unless you have got a hotline to Emmanuel Macron. Now, I'm not doubting that he's got more important things to do than keep his eyes on cycling, but it's huge for the nation of France, this, isn't it? Paul Sexsas is going to be carrying the hopes of a nation on his shoulders. Whether it's this summer, it's certainly very soon. I mean, it just seems to me an absolute no-brainer now to bung him into the Tour de France and see how he gets on. And I think Sunday's race, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, with the distance and the fact that the field will be deeper and it is tactically a bit more sophisticated, and there's, you know, a lot more to it, that run in back into Liège, that will tell us a lot about exactly where he is. But today was very impressive. I mean, it was so routine, wasn't it? They started the bottom of the Mur de Huy in a sort of Formula One grid order, and they reached the top in more or less the same order. And Sexsas was front and centre all the way up the climb. His team did a pretty good job of getting him into the position. There was one of his teammates who came to a bit of a grinding halt at the bottom. I'm not sure who that was, but I wonder.
Lionel, we better save this, because Mur de Huy is literally 1 kilometre of action. If we don't save something, we're not going to have anything to discuss in the second part.
Well, no, we can throw forward to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, can't we? But I mean, he bossed it. He absolutely bossed it. He rode there, and your comment about him being too tall, was on my mind as I watched him go up, because he almost looked like he was getting a sort of sedan chair ride up through that first Z bend, the famous part. You know, he was just nudging ahead of, I think at that point it was Ben Tulett of Visma Lisa Bike and Benoit Cosnefroid of UAE Team Emirates, and then he kind of serenely coasted ahead. There were a couple of moments where he looked a little bit ungainly and his sort of height.
He does sort of fight the bike, doesn't he?
Yeah, but you know, I think, you know, that looked pretty good. He wasn't wrestling it, manhandling it, was he? He was kind of just cranking it over. I very impressive performance. And the tallest, asterisk, we don't quite know whether he's the tallest
this century. Definitely the tallest this century. I would suggest he's probably the tallest ever.
Probably the tallest on the Mur de Huy, I would have thought, looking back at the winners since 1985. Mm. And the youngest ever winner, still only 19. And we're going to be saying this, well, we're going to be saying this until he's 20. Mm. And then we'll be saying he's still only 20.
Well, Lionel, in a minute, we're going to recap what action we did see before the Mur de Huy and then what did happen on the climb. But the signs were all there, weren't they? Because yesterday we talked about how explosive he was or wasn't. Of course, the signs were there at the Tour of the Basque Country, not only because he won three stages, but the very day I arrived at the Tour of the Basque Country, Lionel, he didn't win the stage, third stage. They finished up to Basauri, hometown of Machin of UAE. The plot thickens. But a very similar final kilometre that day to the final kilometer in Flèche Wallonne, and he led the peloton home that day in vaguely similar fashion, I would suggest. And that's a good excuse to mention that tomorrow, Lionel, it's fresh out the oven, finished it this morning, hour-long special on Paul Sexas, the week that changed pro cycling, Sexy Basque, Sexas at the Tour of the Basque Country just 10 days ago. Lionel, I think we're going to break the internet. I think we're going to have more listeners than the Joe Rogan Experience. If we get this out in timely fashion tomorrow.
You're surfing the Sexas wave here, aren't you? I mean, the timing couldn't be any better. I'm sure you were sat on the edge of your sofa there in wherever you are. Mallorca, is it? I don't know. I don't know these days. I never know where you are. I don't ask. But I'm sure you were there willing him on to win because it's fallen perfectly for Sexy Basque, and I think it's really made Sunday's race, it's added another layer, another dimension to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which it was already looking good, wasn't it, with Remco Evenepoel winning the Amstel Gold Race at the weekend and Tadej Pogacar resting up after another second place at Paris-Roubaix. Tom Pidcock,
do you want an omen before we do go on to recap what happened today? Omen for Liège-Bastogne-Liège. The village where Paul Sexas has resided for most of his upbringing is called Anse. Same name or same pronunciation, but not the same spelling as the town that used to host, up until a few years ago, the finish of Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Mm. It's quite a tenuous omen, that, really, isn't it? He lives in a place where Liège-Bastogne-Liège used to finish.
Should we get on with the recap?
Yes, let's.
Should we tell people what happened? Do you want to start, Lionel?
Well, yes, Daniel. I mean, it wasn't the most tactically sophisticated of races. Flèche Wallonne never really is it? But there was the expected early break, and it had Andreas Leknessund, the Norwegian champion of Uno X, in it, along with Yardi Christian Vanderlee of EF Education. Sjoerd Bax was in there, Jakob Otruba, Alan Josium, and Vincent van Hemelen. And they were kind of out in front, never likely to stay clear for the duration. But
the average speed was very strange for the first hour. Was it on TV the first hour? I wasn't watching at that point.
Not quite.
The first half hour was ridden at 21 kilometres an hour. I wondered whether that was a mistake. Then the second half an hour was 38 kilometres an hour. Third half an hour, 31 kilometres an hour. And then the fourth half an hour, 58.8 kilometres an hour. I don't know whether that was a mistake, but it seems like a very odd pattern.
Where's this data from?
Pro Cycling Stats.
Oh, I can't shed any light on this whatsoever.
I think it's fair to say that we've talked a lot about how the start of races is in big races nowadays is ridden very fast generally, and generally when Tadej Pogacar has been riding, then it's UAE setting the tempo behind, and they're also riding pretty fast, and they're not letting the brake go out too far. I think the pattern today was quite different.
Yeah, I mean, the break went pretty early. It went after about 12 or 14 kilometres or so. So, you're testing me here, but I didn't see what actually happened at the start there. But the break established itself, and it was away, and they stayed clear until the finale. They obviously went over the Mur de Huy first time. It's around about 79 kilometres to go, isn't it? And then it's
41 kilometres to go is the second one.
There were a couple of interesting incidents in on that kind of circuit, wasn't there? There was a crash for Tobias Halland Johannesson of Uno X. Then 21 kilometres to go, Mark Hirschi, former winner that I mentioned earlier, he went down in a crash. Bad day for Tudor Pro Cycling and their two former winners of Flesh Worm, because Julian Alaphilippe, still suffering with illness, he pulled out relatively early. There were another couple of crashes. One saw Brandon Rivera of Ineos Grenadiers go down. And then we saw Axel Laurence with a mechanical problem, I think after a crash. He was running along the road with his bike.
I think that was actually Vauclin that had had the problem. And Laurence had Vauclin's bike. And then Vauclin finished the race on Laurence's bike. And it didn't It didn't go too well for him, because he was obviously, well, we talked yesterday about how he'd finished second in the last two editions, and he finished 13th today. Mm. So remains to be seen. I guess he'll talk after the finish about how uncomfortable he was or wasn't on that bike.
Yeah, so coming into the last 20 kilometres, Lettensund went clear on his own as the bunch was catching the rest of the break. And then it was the gallop towards the Mur de Huy with the final climb just before that, not really shaking things up. It was just, it's the Côte de Chérave, isn't it? And it was just a sort of preamble for it. I mean, nobody's going to go from that point, I would suggest, even though it's close to the finish. It's not really a viable springboard.
No, we haven't really seen any concerted effort the last few years. Although, I mean, I'm always surprised when I watch Flesh Wallon, because, you know, you're sort of used to the cadence of, for example, Milan San Remo, where you know exactly how far the Poggio is from the finish. And when you see Flesh Wallon every year, I'm surprised again by how close to the finish, the summit of that climb is, simply because I'm so used to it not seeming to have any impact on the race. But then when you see, what is it, 4 kilometers, 5 kilometers from the finish, you think, well, why isn't it some kind of springboard? But it simply never is.
It isn't, no. And I think it's partly because afterwards it's that kind of forced downhill, fast road, where they dip into the shadows next to the river, and it all looks a bit sort of it looks a bit dark and foreboding, even on a beautiful bright sunny day like today. And they're all spread across the road and they're going fast, and everybody is waiting for that slightly gnarly, tricky run in to the bottom of the Mur de Huy, and it's all about the positioning there. And I mean, we've talked many times over the years about Flesh Wallon being a slow motion bunch sprint, but I really was struck this year by how it's almost like a Tour de France sprint stage lead out, but without sprint lead out specialists. There's riders kind of trying to do the job of leading out, and perhaps not the sort of thing they're most used to doing. And we saw Groupama trying to get things organized in one side of the road, and Decathlon were grouped together very well sort of in the middle, and we were just waiting to see who would be at the front in position A1 as they got onto the lower slopes of the Mur de Huy. And as I say, it was kind of strange to see, because we are used to somebody going early, or somebody going just that bit too early, or several moves. Somebody looks like they might have it, but then no, they haven't. But this year we didn't really see any of that. We saw
it was quite cagey.
It was very cagey. But I think also, I think Seksas was setting such a fast pace at the front that no one wanted to, you know, take the risk of blowing up too early by going past him.
Yeah, we talked about his style on the bike, how he's obviously tall. We're going to keep talking, and we're going to keep mentioning that. Unusually tall for a winner of Flesh Wallon. And I think that is a bit deceptive, because he does look a little bit ungainly sometimes, and he certainly doesn't look, you know, I was sort of comparing with Lenny Martinez, was next to him at one point on the Mur de Huy, and obviously the bike is sort of right kind of well, Lenny Martinez looks like he's in the bike in the same way that Pogacar does. And it doesn't look as though Seixas is moving that fast. Even in the races earlier this year, Tour de Basque Country second stage, Ardèche Classic as well, when he's just ridden away, for it was Jorgensen in the Ardèche, and well, a whole series of sort of big hitters in the Basque Country. It's only really the gap that tells you he's going fast, because he doesn't look as though he's moving that fast.
No, but no one was able to get onto the shoulder of him, were they, at the crucial moments. And I did fear at one point perhaps he'd gone a bit too strong, a bit too early, and maybe it would all blow up for him. But there was never really any jeopardy. I mean, I think he knew he had it as it comes up onto the slightly flatter section, the sort of finish line shot. It was in the bag by that stage, wasn't it? And very impressive, really. I mean,
yeah.
Mature beyond years, just to know himself that well, and to kind of know the climb so well after, I'm guessing, you know, seeing it in training and then a couple of ascents before the final one to the line. I mean, not a lot of, you know, muscle memory there. So he really knows what he's capable of. Or maybe it's just that he doesn't know what he's capable of, and it was just more than enough for everyone else that was, you know, in his wake.
Lionel, I'll save up my observations on that for part two, because we're gonna have to eke out our observations on Paul Seixas, because the tactical intricacies of the rest of the race have kind of been exhausted. But should we give the top 10? So it's Paul Seixas, the winner. It'll be a miracle if by the end of the season I've actually figured out the order of the letters in the Decathlon CMA CGM acronym.
Well, you got it right.
Yeah, I did, because I'm reading it, but I'll get it wrong in about 2 minutes. So Seixas won in a time of 4 hours 35 minutes. Mauro Schmidt of Jayco Alula was a very good, very strong second. Ben Chula, a surprising and excellent third place, particularly he'd had some problems in the Tour of the Basque Country. Cosme de Foix, who's previously gone well in this race as well, Seixas' countryman, he was fourth for UAE. Skelmoser was fifth, we'll talk about him in part two. Baudin, another Frenchman, we knew the French would go well. EF Education, Easy Post, he was sixth. Jon Izagirre, Evergreen Jon Izagirre of Cofidis was seventh. Lenny Martinez was eighth. Romain Grégoire, another Frenchman of Groupama, was ninth. And Andreas Kroon of Uno X Mobility was 10th. Just pick out a couple of others. Vauclin was 13th. Peo Bilbao, 18th. Anyone else?
Well, the other debutant,
like to highlight?
The other debutant, Daniel Leo Bissio, also of Decathlon CMA CGM, he was 15th, and former winner Dylan Turns of Cofidis was 21st. You mentioned Ben Tulit there. Absolutely right. He crashed out of the Itzulia Tour of the Basque Country, didn't he? And scratched Amstel Gold at the weekend and was kind of touch and go whether to start. And well, it gives Visma Lisebike something to pin some hopes on for Sunday, I would suggest. But yeah, Schmidt, Tulit, Cosme de Foix, Skelmoser as the riders in Paul Seixas' wake. And I suppose that sort of highlights the absence of Pogacar and Evenepoel and perhaps one or two others. But take nothing away from Paul Seixas, because he won it with the legs. Probably didn't even need to call on the head, I think is probably the summary.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Car Gurus. Because buying a car is a big decision, and it can sometimes feel a bit like a guessing game, wondering whether you're getting the best price. Is the dealer telling me everything I need to know? Has the price changed recently? Well, Car Gurus can help you feel confident in your decision, spotting a great deal and steering clear of any surprises. Car Gurus puts you in the driving seat with complete car specifications, car history, price change information and dealer reviews. With Car Gurus, you get real-time alerts for price drops and new listings, so you'll never miss out on a good deal. Join the millions who've already found their best deal with Car Gurus. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's cargurus.co.uk. Cargurus.co.uk. Search by sorted.
Well, Lionel, the clocks have been stopped. Remember where you were on this Wednesday afternoon. Historic debut in Flèche Wallonne for Paul Sexas. And when I say the clocks have stopped, I also mean the stopwatches, because the times are in, on social media at least. People are suggesting this is the third fastest. His was the third fastest ascent ever of the Mur de Huit in Flèche Wallonne. Fastest ever Julien Alaphilippe 2021, 2 minutes 41. Alejandro Valverde, same time in 2014. Sexas, 2:43 today, so 2 seconds slower. Tadej Pogacar, last year, everyone remembers the extremely emphatic way in which Pogacar dropped everyone last year. And that was 12 seconds slower.
Horrible weather, though, wasn't it?
It was horrible weather. It was horrible weather. Lionel, just a couple of things I wanted to say about the approach of Decathlon to the Mur de Huit and also Sexas himself. First thing I'm supposed to say is we wondered, you know, how is he going to cope with this climb, which is so sort of beguiling to other riders or has been. I believe he'd been doing sort of specific kind of 3 minute efforts in training before Flèche Wallonne, tailored for the Mur de Huit. And he also has said, and he feels that anything under 2 minutes, he's not explosive enough. But 3 minutes, around about 3 minutes, which is what the Mur de Huit is, then he can, his strength will tell. And I think that's what we're seeing with Sexas, that he has this whole sort of repertoire of abilities, but he's stronger in some areas than others. But he's so strong generally that even against riders who on paper might be faster than him on a flat finish, he's usually going to beat them simply because he's stronger. And maybe this has been the case with Pogacar as well to a large extent. So, you know, the terms we often use, is he explosive, is he not explosive, and they become a little bit redundant with a rider this fast. That's what it looks like. The other big question, of course, was positioning. And I don't know about you, but when I saw the position he went into the Mur de Huit in, I sort of said to myself, well, he hasn't lost it because of positioning. Definitely not. Because that was a possibility, and it is a possibility. And it's a bit of a cliche, but you can't win Mur de Huit, you can't win Flèche Wallonne in the sort of 300-400 meters before you get onto the Mur de Huit, but you can lose it. And I think that was the case with some riders today, Skelmose in particular. I've looked hard and sort of stopped the video right at the bottom, and I can't see him anywhere in the top 20 positions. I don't know what happened to him exactly, but then he did a bit of a remontada and was fifth, wasn't he? And seemed to be finishing fast as well, but I think he made a bit of a hash of that, that leading to the Mur de Huit. And just generally on Decathlon, I mean, we're sort of taking for granted that they're going to be good and they're going to ride well in every race at the moment, or certainly every race where Sexas is present. And I think this really highlights the kind of unifying effect of having a rider and galvanizing effect of having a rider who is that strong. I think we're seeing, okay, some of them are young and, you know, we haven't seen a lot of them over the years, people like Labrosse and Bissio, but they seem to be performing over and above what we thought their real level was. And that was the case today with Labrosse, did a fantastic lead out into the Mur de Huit. Interestingly, Sexas said in his interview afterwards that there were a couple of guys in the team who didn't have good days today. I'm not sure exactly who they were. There were a lot of candidates in their lineup for who was going to do the sort of final lead out, or who were going to be the last two riders. It ended up being Labrosse.
Was it Labrosse then who flew into the bottom, set the very hard yes. pace, and then came to a standstill? Yeah, because I think Lapera was there as well, wasn't he? Pretty well positioned for Sexas, but he took control and responsibility of his own positioning, which you have to do, I guess, in the bottom of the Mur de Huit. And as you say, Daniel, it's not a climb where you can afford to be chronically out of position at the bottom, because if you've got riders to come past, we always see somebody kind of come charging through and think, oh, if they could have only been 10-15 places ahead earlier on, they would have been a contender to win. But the positioning at the bottom and making sure that, you know, he had everybody really behind him from so early on were absolutely critical to being able to win. And the fact that nobody took a flyer past him at any point. What was that, because of the pace? I mean, it was quick, obviously. I'd suggest it probably was, but you would have thought somebody, Mauro Schmidt, Benoit Cosnefroy, perhaps, would have tried a bit of a flyer, but I think it was just a case of not being able to. You know, they were trying to cling on, maybe hoping that a little group would emerge and Sexas would do too much and would eventually be coming back to them, but that just never happened.
Yeah, and just in the same way that a few minutes ago I said that some of the sort of terms, the terminology we use to describe riders, whether they're explosive or not, is becoming a bit redundant with Sexas. I think some of the conversations we usually have about riders and positioning are also a bit redundant with regard to Sexas, in the same way that they are to Pogacar. We see this with Pogacar in big one-day races. We talk about places where you have to be in position, and you know, riders get lost and they lose their opportunities because they're not in the right position. Pogacar has this knack, and I think Sexas has it as well, of being able to sort of get himself out of any sticky spot. And, you know, there's an example today on that run into the bottom of the Mil de Huy. You said they were in the middle of the road at one point, Decathlon. They wouldn't have wanted to be in the middle of the road, I don't think, at that point. They would have been wanting to hug one side, and because that's where you get caught in the vortex. And I was sort of worried for Sexas at that point, but then, you know, he's sort of floated through the wheels and he found himself exactly where he probably wanted to be, right at the front, at the bottom of the Mil de Huy. So I think that's something that he finds quite easy, and that is also one of the reasons why he's able to sort of demonstrate the physical gifts that he has with such consistency. And it has been so consistent so far this year. Every time he's appeared, we've seen him in his best light.
Yeah, and you know, the historical context of winning on the Mil de Huy at the first attempt. I mean, Claude Croquillon obviously did it in 1985 because they'd never finished up on the top of the Mil de Huy before that year. Mark Hirschi in 2020, and now Sexas. I think I'm pretty certain they're the only three that have won at the first attempt. The likes of Laurent Jalabert won at the second attempt. Alejandro Valverde won at the second attempt. Julian Alaphilippe was second in 2015 and 16, and then won it in 2018, 19 and 21. And, you know, that was around this period where we were talking about riders who get very close but can't quite get over the line. And obviously Alaphilippe won at the third attempt. Kevin Vauclin was somebody who I thought would potentially do that today, having finished runner-up the last 2 years, but as you say, had his problems, and we assume he finished on Axel Laurence's bike, that far from ideal, and so he finished 13th. But Sexas, yeah, regardless of the positioning, I mean, I would caveat everything we've said about him being there at the front, the sedan chair lift through the middle and all of that. I think if he'd been on the second row of the grid, he probably still would have won it. I think, you know, it wasn't purely down to the good positioning at the bottom. I suspect he probably would have had enough to come past a few people had he needed to, but he didn't need to.
Yeah, and equally, you know, I mentioned Skelmoser. There were other riders as well who weren't in the ideal position. Mauro Schmidt finished second, having been in the wrong position by his own admission, and he had to do a very fast and hard first half of the Mil de Huy to sort of get back into position. However, had he been in perfect position, I still suspect that he wouldn't have challenged poor Sexas. And Schmidt, incidentally, he's an interesting character. I mean, he's obviously Swiss rider, been around for a few years now. Of course, he won a Giro stage on gravel, the sort of it was the Montalcino stage, wasn't it, a few years ago. That was his big breakthrough for NTT. He's got a bit of a reputation as a very un-Swiss Swiss, if you'll excuse the...
What does that mean?
Well, he doesn't
like chocolate or cuckoo clocks. What sort of generalisations are we delving into here?
I believe that one of his nicknames in the team has been at some point the Colombian, because he's quite sort of extroverted and flamboyant and, as I say, very un-Swiss. I'm sure there are Colombians that I don't know, they probably fulfill the criteria of a stereotypical Swiss person, very punctual and orderly and not given to, I don't know, outlandish displays of emotion, whatever. But apparently he's the opposite anyway.
Well, he's having a very good week because he was sixth at the Amstel Gold Race on Sunday, second today, and will be a factor at Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday. And speaking of which, I mean, Paul Sexas's victory today, as I said earlier, adds another dimension to what was already shaping up to be a good race. Pogacar trying to win it again. He's had a little bit of a break. We've had a pog-free fortnight. Remco Evenepoel is in great form, won Amstel Gold in impressive fashion. All right, the field wasn't that deep, but nevertheless, he seized every opportunity and saw it home strongly. He's a twice winner of Liège-Bastogne-Liège a few years back, of course, now. Tom Pidcock today, he won a stage in the Tour of the Alps. Of course, he had that terrifying crash in Catalonia a month ago and rejigged his race program to give himself a few more days of racing. And we speculated in yesterday's episode, Daniel, about, you know, is he going to go too deep? Will he show too much? Or is it just about kind of riding himself back into the sort of form he might need to be a contender on Sunday? And now, of course, Sexas. And the big question mark that I would have posed is Sexas and very long races. Liège-Bastogne-Liège is 260 plus kilometres. But of course, we only have to go back to last year. He finished 13th in a very difficult World Championship road race in Rwanda. That was 267 kilometres. He was 7th in Ile Lombardia. That's 241 kilometres. He was 3rd in the Euros, which was 202 kilometres. A couple of long stages in the Dauphiné. And then this season, Strade Bianche, he was 2nd. That's 203 kilometres, and today 200 kilometres. Now, we always talk about the difference between the sort of 200 kilometre races and the 260 kilometre races, and that can be significant. So it would be very interesting to see how he fares in that final, 60, 80k, when it's just kind of getting started, isn't it? Mm. Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You know, Larry Duke comes, you know, quite a long way from the finish, but also after a very long time in the saddle. So I think that's going to be the crunch point for Sexas, but I haven't seen anything yet to suggest that he's suddenly going to crumple when put under pressure, you know, deep into a long race.
No, I just hope we don't get to the point so quickly and so early in his career that anything other than a victory starts to be, even against Pogacar, starts to be seen as a little bit of a disappointment, as a little bit of an anticlimax. Because you can imagine, maybe he won't now become the favourite for Sunday, but I think he will certainly be the second favourite, and certainly the French press will be pushing a narrative that he's even more of a favourite than Remco Evenepoel, for example. And winning a part, it's very difficult to see how he can exceed expectations at the weekend. Of course, the other thing to bear in mind about Sunday, Lionel, is, as we know, Dick Adelon are going to make the decision about the Tour de France after Liège-Bastogne-Liège. They've promised. So Sunday night, I think, they're going to make the decision. And presumably, so the next chunk of racing for him, if there is going to be a next sort of chunk of racing in, you would think that if he's doing the Tour, he'll probably do the Dauphiné. But that will all be decided on Sunday night.
Yeah, so if he finishes 8th and we're talking in Arrivé on Sunday, that he's washed 19 and he's done.
I mean, I don't know whether I said this on the podcast, but I've been saying this to a few people recently. I have vivid memories of 2004, the spring of 2004, and a rider called Thomas Lovqvist won the Circuit de la Sarthe, and he was 20 years old. And this was seen as absolutely earth-shattering news that a 20-year-old could win a pro race. And that was
the nobody under 32 won anything in those days. That was how it was. It was an old man's sport, really, wasn't it? I mean, the generational difference between then and now is remarkable. I mean, even pre-POG, you couldn't have imagined a teenager making this sort of impact. I mean, Remco Evenepoel, I mean, his jump from junior level to pro level, completely skipping the under 23 ranks, more or less anyway, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? But even Evenepoel, there's something a little less dynamic about him in some way. I think he's not quite as dynamic as Pogacar or Seksas. I mean, Seksas looks like the successor to Pogacar now, and everyone's going to be saying it, and he's going to have to wear that weight of expectation. But he looks very, very level-headed. He looks like he's just taking everything in his stride so far. So I wouldn't necessarily put anything past him at this point. You know, Remco Evenepoel, we've seen him kind of have, you know, for want of a better phrase, sort of mini meltdowns in races. Liège-Bastogne-Liège, was it last year? Which year was it when, you know, he was out of position? It was on the
La Redoute
La Redoute, and then the Côte de Forge, you know, and he just kind of looked really out of sorts and as if he wanted to sort of chuck in the towel a bit, really. Whereas we haven't seen enough of Seksas to see him, you know, under any kind of pressure yet. So let's hope they really put him under pressure on Sunday and we see how he responds.
Well, yeah. And the other bit of good news with Paul Seksas is, besides the Course de Macron and my singing, we've got years left of puns for headlines and episode titles. Last week? We've done so many podcasts recently that I'm losing track of time. But when we had Larry on, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Paul Seksas. Of course we did. And a listener, I'll tell you who the listener was, Mr. Cronenberg, sent me a screenshot of he was playing the podcast, and I think it looks like it's Spotify. And of course you get a transcription, you get a real-time transcription now of the podcast. And while Larry was talking about Paul Seksas, the text on Mr. Cronenberg's screen read, "I don't think they would have dropped Sex Sauce."
Well, the auto-translate there, or auto-transcript, going to have a bit of fun with Paul Seksas. Yeah. And
Sexy Basque is out tomorrow.
Yeah, Sexy Basque out tomorrow. We'll see what happens on Sunday. We'll be back on Sunday, won't we, after another 6.5 hours in the armchair watching the cycling. I think between the monuments, I'll have clocked up a full day of watching flag to finish line coverage of the monument so far this season. We'll be back on duty on Sunday to see how this showdown goes between the, I guess we're going to have to think of them as a sort of big four, aren't we, really? The four? Pidcock just about three and a half. I mean, you know, he's still four. On the sort of comeback. Still on the comeback to an extent. Will be interesting to see, you know, how he emerges from the Tour of the Alps this week. But mouth-watering Liège-Bastogne-Liège all of a sudden, from a point where maybe a fortnight ago we would have been looking at just a sort of pog procession again. It may not be that straightforward.
We'll be back on Sunday. Do you know what? We didn't even talk about the fact that Paul Seksas, I think, crashed at some point today. But we don't know where. Dark side of the moon.
It was somewhere in the Ardennes. And also, we didn't mention that it was the second fastest edition of Flèche Wallonne. There was quite a strong wind at times, and that was at their backs for key parts of the course. I don't know. I can't remember from riding the Mur de Huy whether I would... I don't think the wind would have made any difference to my performance riding the climb. It's too steep for the... it's too steep for the hedgehog of Not Watford. But I don't know. And also it zigzags a bit and it's got houses on either side and it's a little bit tree shaded as well. So I'm not sure we can sort of blame the wind for or credit the wind for Paul Seksas' time on the Mur de Huy. But a very fast race nonetheless, despite the weird average speeds in the first hour, Daniel.
That's another mystery that needs to be
maybe.
Maybe Emmanuel Macron will be able to help us with that. Anyway, let's see if Macron's back on the podcast on Sunday. Thanks to him for his cameo again today. And thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.